other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by Porn Corn Pop Slop, a snacking experience like no other. My name's Aaron, apparently personal pals Brick.
Hey.
Dave.
Hey, boys.
And calling in from Hibernia itself, old Irish Nico.
I take offense to that. We're beyond the pale out here.
Wait, is Hibernia an offensive term? I thought it was just like, I thought it was from Ireland.
I have no idea. I thought it was England.
I think Hibernia is like a Irish.
Probably. Never mind. I retract my offense.
No, don't do that.
Yeah, keep it.
Yeah, Hibernia is the classical Latin name for the island of Ireland.
Wow.
Yeah.
You really should be.
Yeah, that's your Prussian name.
Old Prussian Nico.
That's really old.
Well, appropriate enough that we're discussing the nature of the word Hibernia, because this episode is dedicated to Irish novel by an Irish writer. And Kevin Barry. Night Boats of Tangier is our topic today. This is a story club, book club episode. We've all read this book and wanted to chat about it. Now, Dave, you read this before all of us. You brought this to us in the first place. You are the Kevin Barry super fan in this group. So tell us how you came to this book. Give us kind of your first experience with it before we launch into our discussion.
Well, I've kept up with Kevin Barry. I think Nico was the first to read Kevin Barry, his first novel, City of Bohan. Then he recommended it to me, and I read it and liked it. And then Barry's second novel, Beetlebone, I really loved and tried to get you guys to read for a group read that kind of petered out. And so, but I've read, and he also has two story collections, and I snapped those up and have read through them several times. So he's put out 5 books, and I've probably read 15 times through those 5 books.
Wow.
And this one, I think, is, I thought you guys might like it. It's somewhat, reminds me a little bit of Sisters Brothers, which we can talk about later. But I thought you guys might dig it, and it would be fun to talk about. So here we are.
Yeah, this is a recent novel, right? Came out 2018, maybe something like that? Or 19?
I think last fall it came out in the...
Yeah, 2019. And it was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Like, the reviews have been really good for this book. I was reading through some of them in prep, and a lot of positive things to say about this novel. So, Dave, what do you like about it? Give me your take on this book.
Well, I think I've talked about it in previous What Are We Readings. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm more curious to see how it hit you guys. I guess what your Barry experiences are. Nico, I know you read Bohan, like I just mentioned, and the rest of you started Beetlebone, but maybe never got through all of it. Have you read anything else from him?
No, I haven't.
No.
I did try Beetlebone, but its premise was a little too contrived, might be a hard word, but like kind of, you know, a little too precious for me. Just like not, I maybe if I was a bigger Beatles fan, like it's about like John Lennon suddenly waking up in Ireland, right? And like kind of wandering around. Is that right?
Yeah, he...
going to his lake house.
The real John Lennon bought an island off the coast of Ireland, but never really did anything with it. And so this is Beetlebone, like it's sort of based on that, like an imagined version of John Lennon trying to get to his island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was... That one just didn't grab me, I think. I think his writing is better than his plots, and maybe better than his characters. It was the same in City of Bohan. It was like, it was well written. There were a lot of like little kind of gems in it. And that's a lot like what I thought of Tangier. But the plot didn't really execute on its potential, I guess. Does that make sense?
You're saying that about Nightboat, or that's about Beetlebone?
Well, I didn't.
Nightboat. Or both?
But Nightboat and City of Bohan. It's been a while since I read City of Bohan. That's kind of what I remember of it. It's like it was very well written, but you know, so like Nightboat, just to kind of set the stage, I guess, is about these two old Irish drug runners who are looking for one of them's daughter, but they don't actually know technically whose daughter it is, because the guy who was married to the mother, one guy was married to the mother and the other guy was having an affair with her, an extended affair. Right. So they're kind of like tied together in that way. And they were in business for years and years, and they're kind of just sitting at this dock waiting for this boat to come in that might or might not have the daughter on it. And then the rest of it is kind of flashbacks and stuff and to different times.
Yeah, in terms of like actual plot, there isn't much that happens. Like it's sitting around having conversations, right? Like in terms of like the linear plot, but the flashback structure is the novel. really. Right. It goes way back in the past.
Yeah. So for me, it's a little bit like, it's one of those novels that like kind of does the Pulp Fiction technique where it takes the plot and kind of chops it up and does it all out of order. And I'm not sure if it didn't do that. So you're kind of always trying to piece together what is actually happening, you know, and I'm not sure if it was just kind of straightforward, like A to B, if it would be a great plot.
Well, I agree with that, but I don't know that's a flaw for me, because the nature of this story is reflection, right? I think it has to be told this way. And yeah, like the actual elements, plot elements add up into what happens, like, are not particularly unique necessarily. They're kind of standard underworld fiction beats, like deal goes sour, there's good times, there's bad times, there's infighting, that kind of stuff is pretty familiar. But the way it's told, the way it kind of dips back in and out, and the way it sort of uses those memories to inflect the current situation they're in, and the more you learn about their past, the sadder their situation becomes, right? I feel like I was picking up on that when it first started out, I was like, hey, whatever, these guys seem like they're scum. And then by the end, you're like, well, I feel a bit more for them now. I still think they're kind of scummy, but the sort of trip you've gone on makes that situation of being stuck in that ferry terminal, whatever it is, waiting for this daughter. And then when they, well, I guess spoiler alert for this book, if you haven't read it by now, we're going to get into plot details. So stop and read it and come back if you want to. When they eventually don't find her, when she's there and they miss her, the resonance of that hits really hard. Whereas it wouldn't if it was told, I think, from A to B, like you're saying.
And, you know, I had a theory that, because it seems like there's a moment where the daughter, where Dilly walks past them, and it seems as if they do recognize her and choose kind of just to let her go, which I thought was interesting. I don't know how deep we want to get into plot, but that was a moment that jumped out to me.
I thought that same thing too. I couldn't tell how much of it was they decided not to, or if it was they just weren't sure enough and didn't feel like they couldn't act. So there's sort of like a sense of, well, what are we going to do anyway, right, if we do find her? Kind of the feeling I got towards the end of the book was what they really want is to die.
Right,
yeah.
I think more than anything. And just to be over with life. And that even finding her wouldn't be satisfying, because it'd be in the same position they were before, which was
right.
No relationship, no connection.
Yeah, and it seems that the reason, at least their express reason for finding her, is they think that she stole a bunch of money from them. So they're not necessarily trying to reunite with her for familial reasons, but more like, let's go get our money back. And then, so I think when they do see her, if they actually recognize her, maybe that's a moment where they're just like, let's let her keep that and let her go live her life, because what does it matter? We just really
right.
don't want to keep living anymore ourselves.
I think I must have missed that. I didn't get that they were trying to get money from her.
Mm.
Okay, that's interesting. That changes it a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't
passage for that, but continue.
Yeah. I didn't get that either, but I did get the sense kind of as the book went on, like, so it starts out and the two guys are Moss and Charlie, and Charlie's kind of introduced as like the hard guy. You know, he's the guy who can just look people yeah. in the eyes, and they know that he will ruin them, and they believe it. And then they like do whatever he says, you know, kind of a classic like criminal novel kind of thing. And then as things go on, you kind of and so they're kind of first portrayed as like criminal kind of hard cases. And then as it goes on, they just kind of seem to be fuck ups that kind of lucked into this connection. And
yeah, like sad fuck ups.
Yeah. And at one point they like lose like €1 million worth of hash. And like, it just like, they just can't remember where it is. They buried it somewhere and they can't remember. And then by the time it got to where Dilly, the daughter, was like walking through the terminal, and like she sees them immediately. She sits down, she has a beer, she's like, thinks about what she's going to do, and she winds up just walking right past them and looking at them, because she thinks they're such fuck ups that they're not even going to recognize her, and they don't. And I that's how I read it. It was just like, they just didn't, they're just too shitty at what they do to actually find her. You know?
Yeah, well, they are fuck-ups, but they're not... I mean, they're violent, right? They are murderers.
Oh, yeah. But also violent in kind of an almost, like, impotent way. The way... That,
yeah.
Like, just not violent in the way that they're particularly talented or, like, good at, you know, intimidating people. Just that they'll cut each other's eyes open or, you know, stab each other in the knee. Yeah.
Yeah, like there's like a savagery that's just like they are willing to carry through with horrific violence. Like, yeah. They're not kingpins, and they're not necessarily particularly good at running their organization, as they suppose they were for a while. But they're just willing to be like horrible. The money thing changes that, because that's, I had the same reading, Nico, where I was like, they kind of want, I thought they were trying to find her just to like reconnect, and they were just like,
yeah,
sad. But if they were looking for money from her and she knew that, then her reluctance to see them again would makes it changes that decision, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I found one passage if you guys want to really get into it.
Yeah,
but there's, I know there's another one or two later. So it goes, there was a lot of money unaccounted for, Maurice says. It remains so. Cynthia, who is Dilly's mom, Cynthia couldn't have spent it all despite her very best efforts. The next graph goes, Dilly Hearn, Charlie says. She's a small girl. She's a pretty girl. And then Maurice says, she may just possibly have done us over.
Okay. Huh.
And the she there could be the mother, but it does, I mean, even if Cynthia stole a bunch of money off of them, what's she going to do with it other than give it to Dilly?
Right.
But at the same time, like Dilly, there's that whole long passage where Dilly goes over her finances and she has like less than €1,000, like when she starts out. You know, so it's like how much could she have possibly taken? €800 when they're running like, I don't know, a ton and a half of hash at a time. I don't know. It's,
or she's giving it to the character she meets in that warehouse. I can't remember the character's name now. Like the trans person.
Trans maybe pimp.
Yeah, maybe. Couldn't quite tell what that was.
Yeah.
But I mean, if she has a ton of their money, she's not going to walk around with it in Tangier or in.
It's also like five years later, isn't it?
It's also, she's going to have it stashed somewhere.
I guess. I just wouldn't, I guess I wouldn't understand the point of that whole, like there's, like half of her section is just her thinking about money and like what she does, how much it costs, how much she has left now.
Well, but in a way she's a product of these two fuck up criminals, right? So that's, I mean, that's largely what her, kind of her role in the book is, which is, you know, not super great, but also... I think it sort of pulls the story together. I think I largely felt like you did about the plot for most of the book. And then when Dilly showed up, it brought things together for me a little more, where I kind of started to see that, you know, I still wish that had a little more substance to it, but her chapters kind of solidified the sort of emotional narrative of the story pretty well, I thought.
Yeah, it really does change it. I was, when I got to that chapter and sort of like my thinking that I had it figured out, I was like, oh, this is the last chapter. They're going to see her or not. And it'll end. That's kind of like a poetic ending. I was like, that's pretty good, but not super surprising. And then it kept going. I was like, oh, this is even better.
Yeah.
Like I liked how it changed the chemistry of the novel and then made you sit in that for a while and think about the characters in a different way. Moss and Charlie specifically, which I liked quite a bit. Nico, you mentioned that Kevin Barry, kind of maybe the word in him is a little bit, is the prose style is really good. The plots don't maybe add up as much. The plots aren't as important. The writing here is incredible, I thought.
Yeah,
just that the prose style itself is really gorgeous.
It's very, very good.
And it's not all one thing. Like there's some really lyrical turns of phrase, but also it's kind of staccato too at the same time. It's not easy to read, I don't think. Even though it breezed by, it was challenging to keep up with it.
Yeah. Yep. Well, it's short, so yeah, it's quick to read, but yeah, it's does kind of shift gears a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that first I was trying to read it. I was reading it at night before bed, and I was sort of like reading it in the way I would read a normal novel, sort of like not paying attention, but sort of like kind of like casually. But I was like, oh, this requires a lot more focus. And I had to sort of sit up, right, and read as opposed to like laying down.
I'm kind of I'm a sucker for sentimentality in fiction. And I think Barry does that very well, which is maybe one of the main reasons I'm drawn to him. I get a similar feeling from Barry that I do from Dybbuk, like Coast of Chicago in particular. So I think I'm kind of prone to like anything he does that sort of falls on it. And there's a lot of that in this book. I think that Maurice and Charlie looking back on their lives and feeling dissatisfied with what they did with their lives and how much time has passed and how close to the end they are, even though they're only like in their early 50s. I think they're pretty much checked out now.
There's at one point that mentions him, like he's like, I'm 38. I was like, oh shit,
yeah.
Like I will be 38 next year.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, like, I can't remember which one it was, but one of them says they're talking about whether he should get a dog, and he's like, I'm not sure I have the length of a dog left in me.
Yeah. And then the other guy's like,
he's like 52 years old.
Yeah. And the other guy's like, well, you definitely don't have two dogs.
The sentimentality that Dave mentioned, we talked about it in text a little bit, is interesting because Dave and I are both big Dybbuk fans, but I think you're right, this is a very sentimental novel or has a sentimental style, but I get a different version of the sentimentality here, whereas Dybbuk's to me is a more kind of honeyed, even if the memories aren't always good, there's a sort of like Spielbergian warm glow around them, right? It's like the past is this paradise of sorts, whereas here the sentimentality to me is very sour.
Yeah.
It's like a remembering is pain.
Yeah.
Because life is pain.
Well, which is interesting. Especially for these two.
Or meaninglessness.
Mm, right.
It must be purposeful. This book, I feel, bears a pretty striking resemblance to Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, totally.
And that's a lot of that play, or at least one way of interpreting that play. I mean, it parallels it pretty closely, and it's pretty interesting in the end when Godot or Dilly shows up and then has some agency.
And
some conflict of her own, which was interesting. I liked the point, you know, where Nico brought it up, where she kind of has a beer and she says, you know, part of her want to go talk to them. So she's kind of going through the same, maybe an inversion of it, but the same kind of thing that they go. I'm not convinced they didn't recognize her.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, I like that that's ambiguous.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just came to me that maybe the main reason that this reminds me of the way Dybbuk writes is that regardless of whether the past to the character is like sweet or sour, it seems like they have trouble sort of clinging to the present moment. Like they can't help but slip back into memory. They just like can't hang on to the present moment often. And I kind of feel that way in my own life. Yeah. So I think I'm kind of drawn to that.
I can't imagine why you wouldn't want to hang on to the present moment, Dave. What an exciting time to be alive.
So Dave, in the beginning, compared it to Sisters Brothers, which I think is interesting. And I think it's been a while since I've read Sisters Brothers, but I remember it's, and it's also about these two guys who are ruthless criminals, and like their job is like to do whatever needs to be done. They have a bit more character, I think, than these guys. Like I'm not sure that that Maurice and Charlie have much depth to them. You know, like they're sad. They used to be junkies. They kind of fucked around with each other. That's about it. You know, like I think that's one of the things that kind of doesn't fulfill its potential to me, is like, because like they kind of, like what they do is like they kind of, their best insights are like things like kind of the jokes and the kind of things where they're like the things I remember most about them are when they're like, what's the Spanish word for crusty? And they figure out that it's peroflauta, and it means a dog and a flute. And that's what Irish people would call crusty. And like that kind of thing is way more memorable to me, I guess, than any particular insight they have into their situation. Like, yeah, they have regrets, but I don't think they understand really their lives, I guess.
Seems like a choice maybe that Barry's making, right? Like focus more on plot and character, or write more lyrically and like, you know, I guess somewhat philosophically about all sorts of topics,
right?
Really, whereas Sisters Brothers, yeah, he gets deeper into the characters and the plot is more interesting. The writing, I would say, if memory serves well, is a lot more straightforward than this.
Yeah,
which is not a bad thing. It just seems like choices.
Right. Yeah, and I think that is kind of what I remember from City of Bohane, is like the writing is great and it's clearly what he's focused on. It's like sentence to sentence, turning phrases, and it doesn't really matter if this adds anything to the book, you know?
He almost made up like an entirely new language for that book. Like there are a lot of phrases that don't exist, but that's like a futuristic. I can't quite remember everything about it, but it's like a post-apocalyptic maybe.
Yeah, or alternate.
Something has gone way wrong in that book.
Yeah.
I would say maybe it's a difference between, it doesn't add to the plot necessarily, but it might add, but it adds to the book in terms of the reading experience, right? Like the experience of reading it seems to be more important than taking away a moral or like a, I don't know, like a sort of portable plot, right? Sort of like, it's just, you read it and you feel something, and that's, it compares between like literary fiction and genre fiction in some ways then.
Yeah.
Where this is about voice and not about plot as much.
Yeah, it's hard to even describe, like a lot of this plot is just waiting in a ferry terminal. Just like, I can't remember, maybe it was Nico when we were talking about reading Beetlebone said something like, does anything else happen or is the whole book just John Lennon riding around in a car? It's like, that is what a lot of it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess a lot depends on what you're looking for.
There's also that kind of weird part where there's like an extended memory of them like building a house and like the intricacies of like dealing with the builders, and like there's a fairy fort on the property, and like that was super weird. That was like like, it, I don't know. It just doesn't, like, in a book about this weird life, I guess that's part of their spoils, I guess, was that, or maybe just part of their fuck-uppery was, like, they managed to turn what should have been pretty easy way to make money into, I guess, I mean, it was supposed to be, like, completely empty. And then at one point they refer to, like, how much money they made off that terrace. I didn't really understand that part.
Wasn't it like a money laundering scheme? I thought they were, like, hiding money in real estate, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
It started to go wrong because none of these builders wanted to be near his ferry for it.
Right, right.
Dipping a toe in Irish mysticism. But Nico, as now officially old Irish Nico, as someone who's lived in Ireland, what, for 2 or so years now, do you have any kind of take, insight into this book that we might not have?
So we actually had, our book club today, actually, and we were talking about this book with some Irish people, and they were like, they didn't understand any of the slang. They were like, probably if anything, like, more confused by it than me and Kathleen were. Like, I think, so they said it was, like, pretty old, and, like, I mean, it, probably what he did is, like, kind of made some shit up that sounded a little bit Irish, but, like, wasn't really Irish, which is weird to me. Like, I mean, his kind of sensibility.
Like what?
Just like his phrase, like the phrases that...
I Googled a few of these things, and a lot of them are specific to Cork, where the characters are from.
Mm. So that could
be. Even though Barry is from Sligo, where you are.
Which is pretty crazy.
Was he at your book club?
Yeah, go track him down.
Well, I mean, he could only Skype in because of the virus, but yeah.
Let's do it. Let's ask him. Let's grill that motherfucker. Can you nail him?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty crazy that he...
Not sexually. Well, maybe.
Yeah. Who knows? Listen, Lady A.
I don't know. That's it could be that they just didn't kind of recognize any of it because everybody here is from the north and the west. But the difference in the accent between, like, Donegal, which is in the northwest, and Cork, which is in the southwest, is, like, pretty pronounced. Weird.
Yeah.
I have another passage about Dilly maybe stealing money and a fresh thought about it.
Mm.
So Charlie and Maurice are talking, and one of the others says, "We'd know somehow at a gut level if she weren't drawing the wind no more," meaning if she were dead. The other one says, "You think she's hawking us over?" The other one says, "It's in her blood to be hawking us. Her mother was the same way, crooked as the day." But now I'm wondering if they are inventing a reason to go see her so that, you know, rather than say, let's go find her because we're worried about her, maybe they are unable to admit that to themselves. So they concoct this, like, scheme, this fantasy that she stole a bunch of, this conspiracy that she stole a bunch of money from them, and that gives them a reason to go check on her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I largely felt the book was a little aimless until the Dilly stuff happened. And then, you know, my read on it was they both wanted to just see her, but that neither of them wanted to be the one that saw her.
Or to admit to having that was a need, right?
That's what I mean. Yeah. So there's this sort of just, like, magnets pushing apart kind of thing where they can't, none of them can pull the trigger, you know, and it plays into all their wistful for these things that sucked, you know, their lives just suck, and it's one more thing that just sucks, and they don't want a life with a daughter. They don't even want to, they have nothing to say to her. They just, you know, they confront their regret in their own way, but they're not going to say it out loud. That's why these things happen in flashbacks and not in conversations. And their conversations are about, you know, the good old days, quote unquote, whereas most of their flashbacks are horrible things like maiming each other and screwing each other's wives and having their records smashed because they can't function in a relationship.
Yeah, I definitely thought that they both, like, it made sense to me when it kind of came out that Charlie could also be her father. And it's like, okay, so that's why they're going. It's because they both have this kind of vested interest in how she's doing and how fucked up they made her childhood. Now that they're kind of semi-sober, they can see it, but...
Yeah, I mean, they obviously have a lot of regrets. Maurice remembers sharply in various spots that moment where he almost kills Dilly and himself, which obviously weighs on him throughout, but it's not until the end that they get explicit with each other about how Dilly could also possibly be Charlie's, and then Maurice doesn't really want to talk about it, if I recall. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on,
right?
I think the biggest weakness that I had in this book was the Cynthia character. I feel like she's a bit thin and needed more, like, this the sequence, the chapter of her dying didn't resonate with me the way I think that maybe it could have, because I didn't really know much about Cynthia.
Her stuff needed to come through Dilly, and it didn't, because obviously she's going to be thin through those two because they are thin thinkers.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe another chapter of her and Dilly kind of coping with life without Maurice would be something there.
I did actually think, like, one of the best character scenes or best character bits was Cynthia when Dilly was, like, asking her about the violence of her childhood and was saying, like, did you ever see Maurice get violent? And she says, yeah, and it made me horny. And, like, just kind of completely missing the point, like, what Dilly, or maybe knowing what Dilly wanted to hear and just not telling her. And she was like, so did you see it? And Cynthia's like, of course I did. Like, what was I supposed to, like, where was I, where else was I going to be? Like, that.
There's also, I mean, there was,
I think that was just one of the most kind of illustrative character moments.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I also, that to me, I read as a, like, implication of, like, domestic violence too, right? There was, like, implication that, like, he, like, roughed her up and she was into that kind of stuff. That's why I read that, at least, is that he wasn't just violent with others, he was violent with her too.
Yeah, possibly. But I mean, like, it made sense then, like, why she was with them, because they were, like, clearly all fuck ups and, like, she liked the fact that he was a fuck up. And that's clearly why she got with Charlie. And, like, yeah, I mean, it's dark, but yeah, I like that detail more.
Yeah, it was, I mean, the whole book is super dark.
Yeah, there's very much darkness happening. Did you guys pick up on the narrator, the we, the plural, the first person plural narrator ever? It's like sprinkled throughout the book and not at all prominent, but often, and it often comes when the writing or the narrator, whatever it is has like a reflection about ghosts, like ghosts haunt this place, and then it's like suddenly it's we.
Interesting.
Barry likes to fuck around with, like, in Beetlebone, there's a chapter just past the middle point where suddenly we break from the story and it's first person narration from the point of view of maybe
part of the book
himself, or maybe like the fictionalized writer of the book, which I found really interesting, and somehow it works. And then, so maybe I was already sort of prone to look for kind of, I don't know, gimmickry comes to mind, even though I'm kind of complimenting it. But yeah, throughout there's some wee narration that kind of pops out and is really not explained.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think I mean that seems like a second or third read probably to pick up.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think this was my third.
Yeah, and so much of this was getting used to the prose, the rhythm of the prose style, and kind of like the phrasings of things like that. I mean, I feel like I missed some key stuff, obviously, because I was kind of like trying to make my way through it. So one quick thing before we kind of maybe wrap this one up, one of the negative reviews I saw, or I just found this on Wikipedia, the author, or the writer, critic, says this: the dangers of turning a script into fiction are many, and Barry skirts none of them. I didn't read the whole review because I couldn't, I'm not going to pay for the Sunday Times. Does anyone know, did this start as a script or a screenplay? Do you know anything about that, Dave or Nico? That's interesting. I want to do some research and find out if that's the case. I know that Barry is now adapting it into a movie, so it might be a script that turned into a novel, turned back into a script that Michael Fassbender optioned. So you might get a movie version of Night Boat at Tangier sometime soon.
Yeah, it almost seems like a kind of a more kind of poetic Martin McDonagh. You guys ever read his plays?
Totally.
Yeah.
I can see that.
They're probably neighbors.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. So I was inspired to write a song from this novel. I wrote a song. I wanted to play it for my pals here. You might sense the inspiration from another famous song in this song, but it's an original song that I wrote. So don't think that I just ripped off that song. So here it is.
That was a long walk. Holy shit.
there's
for that shitty 2 minutes joke. Of it,
and I did the whole thing. I spent about an hour doing this the other night. And I'm pretty proud of it.
Wow. That reminds me of when you played the whole A-Team theme as an intro to an episode.
Just to say you can hire the Yak.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Night Boat of Tangier?
That wiped my brain clean.
Yeah, you killed it.
Let us know on Twitter if you liked this book. If you read it, do you want to read it? What do you think? All your thoughts. Find us on Twitter, YakBabies, and email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com. Also, find us on Patreon. Patreon.com/YakBabies for $1 a month. You can get access to all the cool stuff happening there. Patreon is sort of like the things we don't want people to hear. So you have to pay for it because they're disturbing. So find those things there. Roto Bros, Drafts, Power Hours, Emi Machine, lots of good fun and games happening.
Confessions to Crimes?
Yeah, several. Yeah, all the blackmail material you want on the Yak Babies is right there at Patreon for $1 a month. It's really, we're making it surprisingly available for you. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners and especially their patrons past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, and William Howard Taft.